Ladies and gentlemen, let me first thank the organizers to giving me the opportunity to present our design. This is my first acquaintance with the FEL meetings, and I have to say I'm very impressed. Some of the plans I've seen described in the previous talks, for those I think the sentence "the sky is the limit" is still becomes not enough. I mean, one Angstrom lasers at maximum intensities in enormous big projects, that's beyond what I'm used to. One of the things I want to get out of this conference is where, as is clear from my first slide, I'm talking about design. I don't see my arrow. Oh yeah, there it is. Design of a long wavelength FEL for experiment in a high field magnetic lab is the question whether the technology of free electron lasers is such that you can trust the design based on calculations to the 99% already, or we're still at the phase that is a combination of technology, calculation, experience in order to arrive at the specifications you want to have. What do I talk about today? I will say something about the origin of the funding of the new free electron laser in Nijmegen, which is a non-existing yet, and I hope in the coming years you will learn about the development of the Nijmegen far infrared free electron laser. I will say a little bit about the national motivations to provide us with this money. In order to do that, I will also explain some of the science drivers from this new light source based on the in-house users and their dreams to bring science on material science and NMR forward. The last science driver, biomolecular spectroscopy, is my own fascination, but in a way the least important into defining the specifications of the lasers we want to build. It's the progress on high-field magnet science and material science which defines the specifications of the free electron laser to be constructed in Nijmegen. And then I will, of course, tell about the design and system choices for the Nijmegen far-infrared free electron laser. And in very short, it's combining pump probe options and very narrow-band tunable pulse-length pulses in one single instrument. Okay. At one point in the Netherlands, it was found out by a committee that we're very short of large facilities. Dutch people like to go to abroad, to Germany, France, other countries, to make use of large facilities, and I think they make an impact as a scientist. But it was realized that we never can, or very rarely, can play the role of a host for a large group of scientists. Of course, everybody here knows this enormous exception, which is the free electron laser Felix. That might you think that the whole Netherlands is occupied with great facilities of that quality. But is that the case? Felix and Lex van der Meer and his team has made an exceptional thing that in this world of free electron lasers it's an established facility. But in general, we were short. And suddenly there was this call for a large-scale facilities where everybody who had to apply only had 4 months the time to put a project together which could cost as much as 25 million euros. So I can tell you now that this is very strange. We have been given the money to buy a free electron laser and a hybrid high-field magnet without having done the detailed design studies which are usually the case when you propose such a big instrument. What we propose is to create something which for now is called the Nijmegen Center for Advanced Spectroscopy, where we combine with the high field magnet in the middle and the NMR facility here, a nano laboratory for nano spectroscopy, a laser facility where they do trace gas analysis, and the new things to be constructed was a terahertz far infrared free electron laser. Why far infrared? Because it would help the high field magnet lab to do the same progress as they want to do in the Tallahassee National High Field Magnet Laboratory facility. And the dream is to make the terahertz also interact with NMR, to maybe enhance in the future the sensitivity of NMR by a few orders of magnitude. So let me mention once more this NanoLab. The NanoLab is an existing laboratory, and it is built to facilitate access to nanoscience and technology for small and medium-sized enterprises. The laser laboratory was an existing European facility, a trace gas facility, where there are many lasers in the infrared, in the near infrared, to do trace gas detection on the part per billion range for biological and medical applications. And the sensitivity they can offer to users is about a factor of 100 better than the best commercially available equipment. So those were only two legs of this five-legged animal, which will be the Nijmegen Center for Advanced Spectroscopy, of which investment will be financed to build the extra laser. So in order to have a system, a new system, which can interact effectively with two existing institutes, NMR and High Field Magnet Lab, we have to physically position it in between. So this is the... This is the science, the new building of the science faculty, which is open now. Actually, my department is moving these days from the old building to this new building, and everything is packed up at the moment. Here is the NMR pavilion, which will in the end will have a Dutch-like canal around it to keep the people away, to not get perturbations on the magnetic field. And here is the high field, the existing high field magnet lab photographed during the opening. And physically, it is this distance away from the NMR. It's about 30 meters. So our new free electron laser will be built underground under what is now a parking lot and this road, such that the beam lines can interact in principle with the NMR and with the high field magnet lab. You see, it's positioned here on the close to the German border, and the free electron laser Felix is somewhere exactly centered in the Netherlands, but the Netherlands is very small. Actually, as we heard this morning, George Neal runs ultramarathons, and he can cover the distance within a day simply running. So that's about the feeling of the distance between our two facilities. So, the science drivers have to do with the magnetic fields. What are the magnetic fields present in high field magnet laboratory at present in the Netherlands? Oh, this one. So, this is a timescale of what is possible on magnets. You can have extremely pulsed magnets with extremely high field, where you destroy the magnets, all the way to CW magnets, with fields up to 33 and 41 in hybrid magnets. And in our high field magnet lab, there are a number of 33 Tesla magnets of that magnitude, and the funding will provide the opportunity to create another 45 Tesla magnet. On top of that, there are a few pulsed millisecond magnets, but our free electron laser will be geared towards a radiation source which helps the research in these CW resistive and hybrid magnets from 33 to 45 Tesla. Okay, the collaboration between the NMR and the High Field Magnet Lab can be illustrated already with the fact that NMR people have built an NMR machine inside the 33 Tesla, meaning that they do NMR at a frequency of 1.2 gigahertz. NMR people are different people from magnet people. They talk in the frequency of the proton transition, and magnetic people talk in units of Tesla. Making them talk together always gives rise of confusion. What machine are we really talking about? So this 1.2 gigahertz, 1.27 gigahertz, means you do NMR on protons in a 33 Tesla field. And this is one of the highest NMR operating. I think there's also one in Japan doing the same, and of course in Tallahassee. Another example I like very much about the collaboration between NMR, magnets, and a nanoprobe lab is that NMR people dream of increasing their sensitivity. NMR is sensitive in the absolute sense, but it's insensitive in the relative physical sense, that there are many more nuclei present than you can drive with the radio frequency fields, because the energy differences are so small that you work on very small population differences for the signal. So they are dreaming about increasing the population differences such that the signals can potentially be increased by 3 to 4 orders of magnitude. In doing so, they also want to minimize the size of their samples, which is now relatively big. And one of the experiments they try is to put their instrument onto a cantilever of an AFM, such that the absorption of the radio frequency induces an eigenfrequency mode of the cantilever, which is detected by an AFM motion of the whole tip. And the next slide gives you an impression of what happens. So that on the cantilever is a simple, which is inside an inhomogeneous magnetic field, such that if you scan the field, the resonance frequency is on different positions in your sample. And if you modulate it at the eigenfrequency of the cantilever, you start to see resonances. And the red band is where there is resonance, and there you see the yellow and the red change color, meaning you have spin flips. On all the other processions, you see the nice book Larmor precession of the unexcited spins. And this way, they will go to microsamples. And if they talk to me as the responsible person for a new free electron in the far infrared, they say, on cantilevers and tips, you can couple in the far infrared and get very localized excitations in the terahertz. So that also maybe our far infrared laser might be used in a nano laboratory, which is small enough to bring their machines to our laser lab in the future. Oh, next. That's it. Thank you. Someone else moved the mouse. Okay, let's go to the science drivers. The science driver for high magnetic field is that, in principle, magnetic field people cause their own problems. First, you have small fields and easy radiation sources to do your experiment. Then you increase the fields, and all elementary excitations go to higher and higher frequency. So this is the band of electron spin and electron resonance excitations. So at some point, if you've created your 33 or 35 Tesla, the elementary excitations go into the terahertz, where at that moment there are no proper radiation sources anymore to perform the experiments you really like to do. And those are the pi over 2 and pi pulse excitations. We need high powers to saturate transitions, and where you can study the dynamics of the inside dynamics and beat, so to say, the inhomogeneous broadening of spectral features. And that first they had the high magnetic fields, and now they ask to the other scientists, provide us with the radiation sources around 1 terahertz to do our experiment, but at the same time provide us with enough power and enough flexibility that we can create pulse trains to make pi pulses and pi over 2 pulses in order to play the games which NMR people are used to play and EPR people used to play for a few decades already at much smaller fields. So it's clear that this is the important science driver for our free electron laser. And here I explain again what it means. You have short pulses, very well defined, which make that you drive the population changes fully to the excited level or exactly at the pi over 2 pulse, that is the same kind of population in the upper and lower level. And that requires high power and well-defined pulses. An example is that in using a pi over 2 pulse, the material scientists tell me that during a pulse length of 100 nanoseconds, you need something like 100 watt, extreme narrow bandwidth radiation, of, say, bandwidth of 2 times 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 4, in order to drive a pi over 2 transition. If a physical system requires a transition time of 50 nanoseconds, then the required power goes up by a factor of 4. Half the time, 4 times the power, or 2 times the total energy. And so these are the pulse strain which are desired for a real experiment. First a pi over 2 pulse, then a pi pulse, and then collecting the echo in the far infrared to understand what's happening into your material. This is a very nice one. This is called dynamic nuclear polarization, and it's the science driver which has to do with NMR. So with NMR, they want to enhance the sensitivity. This drawing is not really to scale because this reflects the very small NMR transitions, which are in the radio frequency. They're so small, these energy differences, that the natural difference in the populations is in the order of 10 to the minus 5. And that's the difference in populations which creates the maximum signal you can get. If the system is now coupled to an electron spin, where the transition is much bigger, and which we could pump with a far infrared laser, and the coupling exists, then by coupling this transition, you say to say, take with you not only the electron spin, but also the nuclear spin in the neighborhood. And a way of saying is that you drag as many as possible nuclear spins into the coherent part of your excitation. Then in the experiment, sometimes I have to cut the coupling between electron and NMR spin, and then the NMR people can start and have the full population of the NMR nuclei available. This is the coherent one, which is in a solid, where an electron spin active species and a nuclear spin is in one molecule. In practice, they do it often where the coupling is very weak and during collisions. People can now hyperpolarize, they call it xenon, by letting it interact with rubidium vapor and pumping the rubidium. And every time during collision, slowly the nuclear spin is tilted slightly into the right direction. And then people can even inhale it, and they get an NMR spectrum which is enhanced by a few orders of magnitude, and you get the motion of the gas in the lungs real time into the MRI machine. Okay. The problem is that if you really listen to the NMR people and you translate it to the specifications needed for a far infrared laser, you always need to go to a CW far infrared or a very high duty cycle, because it's an extremely intrinsic high inefficient process. I'm sure we have to find out to see whether a free electron laser ever, at least one we can afford, can provide the total power which is needed in this application. Okay, the third one I just mentioned, molecular spectroscopy. What happens in the far infrared? In the UV, we know we excite electrons. In the near infrared, we excite the high frequency mode of vibration, CH, NH stretches. What you do is you excite motion, but what people use it for is for molecular recognition, because the frequency of the motion is affected by the surrounding, so you use it as a spectroscopic tool. In the far infrared, you excite collective motion in large molecules. And now the big question is this quantum mechanically excited collective motion has to do with the functionality of molecules, especially in biomolecules? And that's a little bit the dream of the biomolecular physics in combination with far infrared. Can we solve one of the large spectroscopic problems? What do you do when you excite a big molecule in the far infrared? Okay, so what were the consequences? I'm responsible for free electron laser, and I've been discussing with the colleagues, and what does it mean for the specifications we have drawn up for this free electron laser? And of course, as many people have experienced with user meetings, users want everything. So they want a continuous wave, but also a picosecond time-resolved pump probe. They want a continuously tunable light source with a variable bandwidth, ranging from a bandwidth of 10 to the minus 5 to the Fourier limit at all pulse structures. They want tunable power up to 10 kilowatt, 100% duty cycle, and a wavelength between 10 micron and 10 millimeters. And then you have to tell, sorry, although there's no physical limitation, there's no law in physics which make it impossible, in practice it's an impossible thing, certainly with the limited budget we have. And if you ask me personally, and I listen to the high magnetic field people, then the importance is to have this quasi-continuous wave, like comparable to a little bit to UC, US, is it wrong? Letters are wrong. The Santa Barbara fell. So, and the Israeli FEL project, where you use a DC accelerator to make long micropulses, which are much more easier to get into a very narrow bandwidth. And the bandwidth can be chosen. There are problems with that. But of course, one implication is that you can never do the pump probe at the picoseconds. And somehow, even in the high field magnetic lab, the scientists say, ooh, that would be a waste to give up that possibility. Although I have warned them that starting with a pulsed laser and ending with narrow band light will not be easy at the same powers which are possible with a DC free electron laser. Okay, what are the design choices? So in a way, I gave way to for the moment, and I say we allow CW and pump probe, a pulsed activity. But that we can stretch the pulses to quasi-continuous with a narrow bandwidth. So we can do pump probe as well as narrow bandwidth in one experiment. The idea is to start with an RF LINAC, possibly up to 1.3 gigahertz, where we fill every bucket with an electron bunch, so that we get a very fast micropulse structure during macropulses, which will be limited. We'll have to have the extension and length of at least 10 microseconds, and where the duty cycle will be determined by the practical things of what is realistic at LINAC or superconducting LINAC. And then the output will consist of microstructure of pulses, which we have the responsibility to phase lock them all, so that we get pulse train of identical pulses to the level of the phase of the carrier wave inside, such that in principle, the total radiation coming out can be compared to an accurate frequency comp, as is done by Ted Hensch and his frequency clocks. So that filtering allows you to get a very narrow bandwidth in the end. But I will repeat that with some details later. And the hope is to end up with a laser which can, during a micropulse, have a power of around 100 watts. And if you keep the micropulse structure, then the power will be about 10 kilowatts during 10 microsecond macropulses. And of course, inside each micropulse, the power will be much larger. And the wavelength choice has chosen to start from 100 micron to 1.5 millimeter. And the reason is that the central frequencies of import to the high field magnet lamp is around somewhere 800 micron, 500 micron, 300 micron. Of course, if you ask them, they also would like 30 or 50 microns. But in Holland, we are lucky that within a one run distance, at least for George Neal, we have another facility where everything between 3 micron and 150 micron is offered already. Okay, so what do we talk about? We talk about an RF LINAC FEL onto an undulator where all the pulses are phase locked. We get micropulse structures separated by the time connected to the 1.3, between 1 and 1.3 gigahertz RF LINAC with megawatt peak powers during the picoseconds of these micropulses, such that these pulses, actually, if you look at the frequency spectrum of them, consist of a very well-defined frequency comp of spectral lines, from which we then, with Fabry-Perot, can filter out one line, such that you get a quasi-continuous, during the whole macropulse, narrow band, which hopefully only consists of a few one longitudinal mode of your cavity. That's the dream, and to establish that on a way where we continuously can tune our laser. The design calculations has to start yet to see where it's feasible with on machine and which will be the limiting factor. Okay. Where does this idea come from? I didn't make it up. We realized that between 1990 and 1998, Lex van der Meer, Dick Oopts, and actually based on calculations of Oopts and Coulson, who gave a very nice introduction yesterday, and later a parallel, also Mady and Charms did calculations, is that, of course, from the beginning when you build FELs, you dream of having narrow band continuous FELs. And what people did is they said, what you have to do to make all those micropulses coherent as possible. You can use the way of the Rossendorf in a way. You do the mode locking system that every pulse goes round and is pumped by the next one, but then the distance between the pulses is so long that your frequency becomes almost quasi-continuous. So now you want to fill these long cavities with many, many pulses, and you have to do something extra to lock the phases. So what you have to do is to put an interferometer inside this long cavity, which connects photons from one electron bunch and make the next electron bunch see photons from the one before, actually from the 31st before, but at least that all the bunches in the end see photons from one source. And that will make them coherent. And Oopts and Bakker, who is here, and Weitz, has shown, and Van der Meer and all, have shown that it's in principle possible. They showed it at around 70 micron that is doable. Okay, so here is the bandwidth of a single pulse, a broad band, say in Felix or this typical laser of about 1% of a little bit more of a few wave numbers, is the bandwidth of a single pulse. If you phase lock all the pulses, it implies you have a set of very well-defined frequencies after phase locking. Now here I put a smiley person and a non-smiley person, because the smiley one says, I have an interferometer which is doing the work. The other person says, the problem with the free electron laser is that there is something which is called spontaneous coherence. That if you build your free electron laser and your electron bunch is small with respect to your wavelength, just the physical structure defines already certain frequencies are preferred, basically the clock of your RF accelerator. So in our design, somehow we have to decouple the clock of our RF LINAC with the structure we want to give with manipulating mirrors in our interferometer and mirrors of our long linear cavity. So these modes, the quality and the width of these modes are defined by the interferometer. And the interferometer was used is a Fox-Smith. Most people will not know a Fox-Smith interferometer, know a Michelson. That's an alternative. It's always been calculated. It's a type of interferometer which varies the path length of the photons in the system. And the bandwidth which you arrive at depends on the quality of the photon coupling of the different pulses. And ideal, of course, that below this, in an ideal FEL, you have the longitudinal modes of the laser. So if you're able to select this, the middle mode of this, in the end you might out with one longitudinal mode, which means that you have a bandwidth limited pulse during the macro structure the macro pulse time, in effect, of course. Okay, so what did they do? Weitz and Oops and Inges, they built a Fox-Smith interferometer inside. So a beam splitter, this is extra losses. And there's an extra path length of this length, which is exactly the difference of one micropulse to the next. And being free electron lasers, then the playing starts of what is the role of detuning and what's the effect of all the different parameters which affect the gain and the saturation intensity of all these lasers and the working of the principle you want to have. And what they had, they used the Michaels interferometer on the exit to probe the interpulse coherence to see what they want to achieve, could they really achieve that. And these are interference oscillations all the way up to the 1.8 meter path length, meaning that you have one pulse and you interfere it with a micropulse 1.8 meter longer, which means 6 micropulses later. If they're really phase locked, you see the complete fringes and visibility. If they're random phases, that means the frequency comb will never be perfect, you see no fringe visibility. And the 1.8 meter was limited, I'm sure, by practical things on the table to build the interferometer, because the real coherence length is probably much longer than this, because there's still full coherence, even if you compare the first with every sixth. 1 minute. Okay. So the three themes are the optimal design for the intercavity phase locking, controlling the spontaneous coherence and the interferometer-induced coherence, especially the material research on the low-loss and effective filtering on the outside. And the planning is that we take a full year to define all the characteristics and translate it to machine building properties, and then another 3 years for the construction and realization of this free electron laser. And I really hope that this conference has been extremely hospitable to allow us to explain what we will be doing, that in the coming years we can show the progress on this project. Thank you very much.
So thank you. The session is now open for questions. Yes.
I ask you two questions.
Sure.
A technical question. If you want to produce a pi over 2 pulse, you can either do it with a short pulse with high power or with a long pulse with much less power, because it goes quadratically, I understand, with the field.
Yes.
How long can you allow the pulse to be?
This is defined by the physical properties of the material that you study. What happens, you induce this pi over 2 transition, and because of the inhomogeneous interaction of the spins or the excitation, they start to dephase. So the excitation time you choose has to be short with respect to the dephasing time, because it's the dephasing time which contains the physics. And this is one of the problems that now I feel although I am in a way atechnical with respect to most of you, I'm supposed to be the technical person. I have to get that information from high field magnet people. And I say, give me an example with the exact times which you need, and that means I can calculate the consequences of the power which is required. And that's not so easy. Basically, they say 100 nanoseconds make us very happy. So 100 nanosecond times make them very happy. So they better tell me in 6 years from now that they're very happy when I provide them with 100 nanoseconds, and that afterwards they don't tell me I rather had 10 nanoseconds. Because you're completely right, the demands grow quadratically on the properties of the system. So that's why the number 100 nanoseconds, there will be a guiding. 100 nanoseconds, 100 watt.
The other question is, how big is the community of users of this kind of
This is now very special about this application. In a way, we have been given the money to satisfy the users which are in-house high-field magnet lab. And the High Field Magnet Lab in the Netherlands is an international facility. So that's the responsibility that now they can offer more. So I cannot give you a detailed answer. They believe, the director, Jan Kees Maan of the High Field Magnet Lab, says if we can have this capability, just like the Tallahassee Lab soon will have, then we can give the material science community a real quantum step. And if it's a quantum step, you expect that people will run in and want to use it. But that is as accurate as I can mention it at this moment.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? If I don't see any, so let's send the speaker again.